Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Hello, and welcome to this installment of the GIH podcast series. I am Colin Peckren, a program director here at Grantmakers in Health. This podcast focuses on working in, and more importantly, with American Indian, Alaska Native tribal communities to improve nutrition and food access. These communities have some of the poorest health outcomes and highest rates of chronic disease and illness in the country. However, they also have a wealth of resources and knowledge that make them invaluable partners to finding culturally based solutions to solve these health disparities. To discuss some of the innovations being developed in tribal communities, how disruptions to indigenous food systems influence individual health, and the opportunities for philanthropy to partner with tribal communities, I am joined by Abigail Echohawk. She is a citizen of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma and Chief Research Officer for the Seattle Indian Health Board, a federally qualified health center serving American Indians and Alaska Natives in King County, Washington. She also serves as director of the Urban Indian Health Institute, a tribal epidemiology center whose mission is to decolonize data for Indigenous people by Indigenous people. The Institute is a public health authority that assists a national network of 62 urban Indian health programs located across the nation. The Institute also conducts culturally rigorous research and evaluation, collects and analyzes data, and provides disease surveillance to strengthen the health of American Indian and Alaska Native communities. So welcome to the podcast, Abigail.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Before we dive into today's topic, there are a lot of popular misconceptions and beliefs about American Indians and Alaska Natives, both in rural and urban settings. I know this could easily be a podcast in and of itself, and not one community is the same. But could you give our audience a quick snapshot of what many tribal communities look like today?
This is a really great question, and I think something that funders really need to consider. There is such a wide diversity in what Indigenous communities look like today. And in fact, many folks don't know that 71% of all American Indians and Alaska Natives currently live in large urban settings across the United States. So here at the Urban Indian Health Institute, that is one of my focus areas, is representing these people. They are tribal people regardless of where they live. Urban is an experience. It's not a kind of Native American. It's an experience that we have. But we are currently living in these large cities across the United States. In addition to that, we have thriving communities located in reservations and villages across the U.S. And all of these communities, whether they're located in cities, whether they're located in rural areas or in reservations and villages, hold a strong connection to their tribal communities, to their culture, to their traditions, to their language, to their knowledge systems, and to the ways of being that they have held on to despite the push of colonialism that attempted to strip that from us. So many of these individuals are living in places that are places where there are great struggles, where there is lack of food access, lack of healthcare access, where those in the cities experience extreme discrimination and racism based on being American Indian or Alaska Native. But despite all of these obstacles, regardless of where we live, our people have maintained and not only survived, but thrived. That is the kind of a community where we can see absolute innovation coming from. And I believe is one place that philanthropy really should be looking at investment into, because how did we do it? How did we thrive in such obstacles? These are lessons that can be taken to not only our communities, but to broader communities outside of the American Indian and Alaska Native experience. And so I'm looking forward to sharing these resiliencies and the strengths of our communities with you today.
You mentioned food sovereignty and holding on to traditional cultural pathways. And food sovereignty is an interesting topic because it's really been a growing movement in the American Indian Alaska Native community and other Indigenous communities around the world. Could you tell our audience what food sovereignty means and how has this disruption to Indigenous foodways played a role in health disparities?
I think we can't talk about food sovereignty without taking a step back and talking about the absolute, not only interruption, but theft of Indigenous land and the removal of our people from the land to which we were connected to. So I'm a Pawnee citizen. I'm also was born and raised in the heart of Alaska amongst the upper Athabaskan people. And I was raised in a way that I know when I step on my traditional land in Alaska, I know that that land knows who I am. I know that I have a relationship with it. And when I look at my Pawnee people, my father's tribe, I don't have that same opportunity that I have in Alaska on our traditional lands as I do in Pawnee, Oklahoma, because my tribe is not from Pawnee, Oklahoma. Like many tribes, we were taken from our land and transported, whether we walked there, however we got there, transported into what is now known as the Indian Territories or other reservations and villages across the United States. And when that happened, when we were removed from our land, we lost so many things. We lost the ability to grow our traditional foods. We lost the ability to practice some of our traditional ceremonies in which our food were a part of. And we lost our land base. We lost our ability to hunt, to gather, to subsist in a reciprocal partnership with the land. And so that's what the food sovereignty movement is doing in American Indian, Alaska Native communities now. It is recognizing the harm that that colonial process did to us when it removed us from our land, when it put environmental toxins on our land, when it destroyed where we used to be and how we used to practice in terms of gathering food. And what it's looking to do is to restore this. For some, the definition of food sovereignty may be different on the East Coast as it would be in Denver, Colorado. So we're looking at the ability of these tribal communities to recognize their unique strengths and connection to the land and reestablish those by cultivating, ensuring access to, and securing nutritious, and culturally we need this food to be produced in a way that is in a reciprocal partnership with the land and with the people. And we are designing and maintaining food systems and enacting policies at the tribal level, at the county levels, at the state levels, at the federal levels that advance tribal priorities for ensuring that all tribal citizens, regardless of where they live in rural or urban settings, have what they need in terms of sustenance in their traditional food to thrive physically, mentally, socially, and culturally. And we don't want that just today. We want that for every generation to come. And so we're the original stewards of the land. And going back to those Indigenous knowledge systems where we are reestablishing our access to healthy, nutritious food that has sustained not only our ancestors, but will sustain our future generations, that is food sovereignty for us and for many tribal communities. How they define that will be different because where they are located regionally is different and their cultural and spiritual traditions are also different. But again, to see these communities reclaiming these systems and building out their communities in this bold, beautiful way has been one of the things that continues to inspire me to do this work.
Well, that's fantastic. I think we'll touch on some of those ways and some ways the communities are doing just that and really raising up those voices in a couple of minutes here. But you touched on a number of challenges as a result of losing land and Indigenous foodways, how that's impacted American Indian and Alaska Native communities, both rural and urban. So could you maybe talk a little bit more about the other challenges that these communities are facing when it comes to food and nutrition? And how is it different for those who are living in urban communities versus those that are still maybe in rural communities or on tribal lands?
When we look at the history of the United States and its treatment of my people, the American Indian Alaska Native communities, we see one that is bloody, tragic, and ongoing. The trauma that my community has experienced didn't stop 50 years ago. It is currently ongoing today. And that is based in the U.S. government doing things like allowing oil companies to do fracking on our land, not allowing true economic development and putting land into trust. Really looking at tribal sovereignty is a key piece of where and how health disparities have arisen. And so one of the things that we saw with the disconnection of our people from our traditional land, for those like my tribal community in Pawnee, Oklahoma, what is now Pawnee, Oklahoma, when we were removed from the Nebraska-Kansas area, one of our main crops was corn. When we reached the Oklahoma territories, our crops did not grow in that land the same way that they grew in Nebraska. And as a result of that, We did not grow the corn that is needed for us, for example, to have certain ceremonies. There are certain ceremonies that we do that are for healing, for example, and you need a certain variety of Pawnee corn in order to have that ceremony. So when we didn't have the corn, we didn't have the ceremony. We didn't have the healing. In addition to that, we simply didn't have the physical sustenance that we had had previously. So not only were we losing and being disconnected from our cultural traditions and our land, but we were also starving. My people in the early 1900s experienced extreme starvation on the Pawnee Reservation. And we have seen this happen across the years. And so while I'm talking about my people in the 1900s, what does that look like today? We see what is often called food deserts in both the reservation areas and then where our people live in the urban cities. However, I do want to be clear, I don't like the phrase food desert, because when I think about the desert native people who had always subsisted off of the desert and had a relationship and thrived in the desert, it places this kind of negative connotation about the land. And that's not what we have as indigenous peoples. And so I think about these as places where they have been economically and food suppressed, not a food desert. They are suppressing economic development and access to healthy foods in these areas. And so our reservations experienced that lack of food. We couldn't grow what we needed. And the U.S. government implemented what was called a commodity food system. In this commodity food system, they gave us flour, they gave us lard, they gave us originally corn syrup, all types of unhealthy foods. And that system continued. Today, there are lots of efforts to change those food systems and to incorporate more healthy foods. But it is a far ways away from obtaining what we truly need in terms of nutrition. When we look at the urban settings, many of our native people are living on traditional land as a result of the discrimination and prejudice that existed. Things like redlining. Here, I live in the city of Seattle. There were policies where they redlined and didn't allow Native people to live in certain parts of our city. And in the 1940s, when those were said to be illegal and Native people could live wherever they wanted, that actually didn't happen. And so as a result of high housing costs, et cetera, our people are almost living in the same areas that were redlined previously. And so some of the most impoverished communities in the country in urban settings is where our Native people live. And we know that those are healthy food suppressed areas, and there's lack of access to these healthy foods. And so these systems of oppression that were rooted in the loss of our land and now have continued as a result of the systems of oppression and institutional and structural racism that has perpetuated these systems, our people currently live in areas where they can't access healthy food, where they can't access good physical activity, where they can't access good healthcare systems. And so what we're looking to do is to undo those and instead look at how do we address and build on the resiliencies of the community to not only get them access, but to actually put them in control of the systems. And that's where the change is. And that's where we're seeing the change across the country right now in tribal communities, both urban and rural, who have taken on control of these systems. We are seeing incredible things happening.
And that's, I think, a rather hopeful note to go into my next question, because I think it's as important as it is to recognize the challenges and the history facing barriers in front of Native peoples. Obviously, as you just noted, that there is a lot of hope. There's a lot of innovation coming from these communities. So could you share some innovative programs, practices, and efforts that are being implemented in these communities?
We have some incredible things going on in our communities right now, starting from tribal communities to what's going on federally, grassroots, and then at individual tribes. And so I'd like to share with you a few of those that I'm really excited about. One starts with the National Congress of American Indians, which is a nonprofit that uses and promotes the needs of federally recognized tribes in the United States. And they have an effort called the Tribal Food Sovereignty Advancement Initiative. And they're supporting the development and strengthening tribal nations' efforts to build and protect their indigenous food systems, because these are the systems that have sustained their citizens, their communities, and their culture for many, many years. And so they've created a forum for tribal leaders to share best practices in advancing food sovereignty. They assist tribal governments in developing food sovereignty and related policies and codes. And they advocate at the federal level for policy change that is needed to improve the quality and accessibility of food, the cultivation of food programs, and protect and sustain their tribal lands, waters, and natural resources, not just for today, but for every generation to come. And so that's one of the exciting things happening on the national tribal level. But we have our incredible grassroots advocates who have been working for so long, pushing for these food sovereignty movements. And they really have been the ones leading this over the last 50 years. So one I wanted to highlight is the I Collective, which is a group of indigenous chefs, activists, herbalists, seed keepers, knowledge keepers, and they are really striving and working towards opening up dialogue and creating a brand new narrative, a new story, a new picture, a new way of understanding that highlights not only the historical indigenous contributions to food systems and to land cultivation and to land stewardship, but they're also promoting their community's resilience and innovations in agriculture, the arts, and society as a whole. So they are really increasing visibility and they're owning their own foods and culture systems, and they promote indigenous ingredients and delicious, yummy foods as they talk about the histories of what has happened in their indigenous communities and how they are working to bring back those indigenous food ways. I think one of the things I really love about this collective is that they are guided by knowing that they are gifting and giving their indigenous knowledge and that the communities are gifting and giving that back. And I think that's one of the ways that philanthropy has always been part of our communities. It's always been about gifting and receiving and also giving back. And so it really is a traditional life way, philanthropy. And this organization is doing that through the gifting and giving of food knowledge and land knowledge. We also have to talk about what the federal government is doing. And, you know, there has been some efforts to correct the missteps that the federal government has done in the past. And so, guided by a tribal advisory board, the Centers for Disease Control was funded to do an effort called Good Health and Wellness in Indian Country. This is their sixth year. They just started their sixth year. In their first 5 years, they made a big mistake. What they did is that when they wrote the congressional language and they put out the request for proposals, they did not put in the proper language that allowed for urban Indian communities to apply for these funds, which were meant to do and to promote healthy lifestyles, physical activity, healthy eating, and using our traditional indigenous knowledge to bring wellness to our communities. They left out the urban Indian communities. And so the first 5 years of Good Health and Wellness in Indian Country, it was only being done in tribal communities located in reservations and villages across the United States. And those reservations and villages did incredible things, but they are missing, like I said, 70% of the population. And so in this second round, which started this year, they have included urban Indian communities. They funded more than 20 in addition to the tribal communities. And we are seeing these urban Indian communities implement things like traditional gardens being grown. There was a traditional garden that was being grown in an urban Indian community that planted the corn seeds of a tribe that couldn't plant them in their own home community, but they could plant them in this urban city where that organization grew that corn and sent it back to the tribe. And so we're seeing these incredible tribal partnerships between urban and rural communities, these efforts being funded by the Centers for Disease Control's Good Health and Wellness in Indian Country. But I would say the effort that is the one closest to my heart right now is the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project. On my father's side, I'm a citizen of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. And in 2003, if you were to ask Pawnee people about what was the status of our traditional foods and specifically our corn, our first mother, part of our creation story, the words you would have heard were, it's extinct, we have none left, the corn didn't grow. You would have heard, we don't even know if these seeds would ever grow again. In 2003, my Aunt Deb Echohawk, who is the seed keeper of the Pawnee Nation, she formed a partnership with a woman by the name of Ronnie O'Brien, who was living in Nebraska. And she worked with Ronnie, and over the course of the years since 2003, they have worked together. And so Ronnie is a non-Indigenous woman. She is a white woman who has worked in strong partnership with the tribe and with my Aunt Deb. And together, they have worked to establish where we now have a strong seed bank with almost every single representative Pawnee corn seed in that seed bank. And in fact, in October of this year, of 2019, Ronnie shipped a box with 127 ears of white sweet corn to the Pawnee Nation. And for the very first time in more than 100 years, this corn was served as part of a healing dance ceremony. This hadn't been done in more than 100 years. This corn was not only feeding us physically, it fed my tribe, my family, my people emotionally, spiritually, and culturally. When we look at the revitalization of food systems and what tribes, grassroots efforts, what government efforts, what we're all trying to do is to heal. And when we talk about eating these traditional foods and having the opportunity to grow them in our communities, both urban and rural, it's not about just the physical feed our bellies. It's also about feeding our mind, feeding our souls, and feeding our spirits. I know and I have seen that when these systems come back, when these foodways come back, we are healing the root causes of the trauma that my people have experienced as a result of colonization. We are reconnecting with our land, with our culture, with our people. And so it's not just about the physical healing. It's about the emotional, spiritual, and cultural healing. And that's what going back to our foodways and establishing food sovereignty across this country is doing. It is healing the root causes of the trauma. So when we're addressing obesity, we're also addressing historical trauma. And so it's a beautiful thing to see these efforts happening across the country.
Wow, that is just some incredible work and stories that you just told. It's really emphasizes that you really have to think differently when you're working with Native communities and doing this work. And I'm glad that you brought up the issue of mistakes, because that is something that philanthropy certainly has its fair share. And certainly we're always trying to learn from mistakes. And certainly American Indian and Alaska Native communities are different from many other communities that philanthropy often works with. And so in order to try to avoid repeating missteps, trying to do better, are there some common mistakes that you have seen organizations, philanthropy, and others make as they've been trying to work with these communities?
I think the most common mistake that I see is one that I've mentioned numerous times, and that's related to not understanding that Native people are currently living in both rural reservation and villages, but also in large urban settings. So our urban Indian communities are very often invisible within the cities that they live in. And there was a government effort that actually went and removed Native people from the reservations and placed them in the cities with the goal of assimilating them into mainstream culture. But what our people did was establish these thriving urban Indian communities, and organizations exist in cities like New York and Denver and Seattle and Portland. And there's these incredible cities. And so often when we see these announcements come out for funding, urban Indian communities aren't included. So definitely recognizing that Native people are living across the United States in a variety of settings, and we are tribal people regardless of where we live. And our experiences, while different, have unique similarities, particularly around colonization and historical trauma. So that is definitely one mistake area in ensuring that there's true inclusion of both urban and rural tribal communities. I think one of the other main mistakes that I see is the assumption that funders have the answer. People often come to our communities because they think we have all of the problems. Well, my message to them is come to our communities, not because you think we have all of the problems, but because you know we have all of the answers. So when I talked about the physical, emotional, spiritual, and cultural healing of my people through a box, a single box of 127 ears of corn, you wouldn't know that, and you wouldn't know how to properly fund that, and you wouldn't know how to properly evaluate that or to tell the story of that unless you were in true reciprocal listening and learning partnership with our communities and recognizing that that answer to healing in my community was rooted in that white sweet corn. But in order to know that, you have to come to us because you know we have the answers, and you have to be willing to listen. And I think that is when we start at that place of community built relationship, reciprocal partnership, that's where we're going to see true change. And to me, those are the two main mistakes that are made when coming into Indigenous communities across the United States.
I think those are all extremely important lessons. And I like that because I think it delves into my next thought really nicely, because obviously, grant makers, they want to help. They want to be better partners with communities, and they do want to listen. So what are some key ways that grant makers can be better partners with Native communities to improve health and nutrition? And where do you see some real collaborative opportunities?
I think one of the key areas has been to really truly listen, from grant makers to listen to the affected communities. You know, I always feel that those who are closest to the pain need to be closest to the power. The communities need to have the ability to truly weigh in on, for example, what a funding opportunity might look like. Is it actually something that's going to work within their communities? Or are we creating all of these, what may be seen as opportunities, but when organizations and tribes look at these, they recognize them as something that's not going to work in their community, so they simply just don't apply. So we want to create true opportunity, which means listening and spending time in the communities and looking for collaborative opportunities. And what will happen in that is that many philanthropic organizations will be challenged by the communities that they sit and they listen to, because there has been a history of racism in this country that is permeated every single system. And so when you sit and you listen and you're challenged by organizations or tribes or individuals who say your system isn't working because it wants us to be like every Westerner that is walking in this world, instead of it doesn't want me to live or work or breathe as a Native person, what you have to recognize is that we're not calling you out. We are not calling you out to cause harm. What we are trying to do is to call you in to good practice. We are calling you into an understanding of these systems that have marginalized our communities. And those are the reasons that we have seen these health disparities not only grow, but be perpetuated through these systems. And so we are calling you into good practice. And that can be hard for folks to listen to. So I ask that people be open and be understanding and be ready to be called into good practice, into new knowledge systems, and to new understandings that may challenge where they currently thought that they were, and instead are saying we could always be better. There are some incredible opportunities right now in tribal communities, both urban and rural, who are doing incredible unfunded projects. They are doing it because they know it's right and they know that it will heal their people. And so there are opportunities to learn and to grow and to see what Indigenous communities are doing. And those are those collaborative opportunities, whether it be in the large national organizations like National Congress of American Indians, to ones like mine, which are smaller but work with urban Indian organizations, to individual tribes and grassroots advocacy efforts. They are looking for true collaborative partners, ones that will listen and work with them to create true meaningful outcomes for the people that they not only serve, but it's their families, it's their loved ones, it's their communities. I think every single day I do this because I want my grandchildren to have a better life than I did.
That's a really powerful message, one that resonates with a lot of people who will be listening to this podcast. So before we wrap up, if you had one message for our audience of health grant makers who really want to make a difference in Native communities, what would that be?
I know I said it before, but this is the key message I have for everybody looking to work in Native communities, other communities of color, and other marginalized communities. Come to us because you know we have the answers, not because you think we have all of the problems. When we make that shift, that opens up a whole new world of understanding and of possibilities. We have the answers. We're just waiting for you to come and listen.
Abigail, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing not only your rich knowledge and experience, but also your perspective on these issues. I think that there's a lot the audience can take away from this. I just really appreciate you for sharing and speaking with me today.
Thank you. I had a great time. I really appreciate this opportunity to share.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.